From KCRW, this is DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. A beloved Hollywood dive bar is coming back to life.
I've had people send me pictures of themselves as little kids actually sitting right here where we are now at the Formosa. You know, we came here in the 70s or the 60s. It just adds this really deep layer of love and appreciation to a place, and we are thrilled to bring it back.
We'll talk to the team that's saving the Formosa Cafe and other historic venues in Los Angeles. First up, though, Wilshire Boulevard Temple held a groundbreaking last week for a new event centre, and it is designed by an architect who is not known for religious buildings, Rem Koolhaas. He is the cool Dutch intellectual architect who, with his Office for Metropolitan Architecture, or OMA, has spent several decades dazzling the world with provocative ideas and buildings. So what's his event centre going to be like? Well, DNA producer Avishai Artsy has been covering this synagogue project since its inception, and he was at the groundbreaking. So Avishai, start by telling us about the original building.
Yeah, so Wilshire Boulevard Temple was built in 1929 by Jewish Hollywood moguls in what's called a neo-Byzantine style. But over the course of several decades, it really needed to be repaired. So architect Brenda Levin was brought in, and she oversaw a complete overhaul of the sanctuary just a few years ago. But what the synagogue still lacked was space to hold sizable functions, things like weddings and bar mitzvahs, but also conferences, staff retreats, things like that.
You mentioned Brenda Levin. She's a very well-regarded architect who's done a lot of really important preservation projects in town. But they wanted a very, I guess, novel piece of architecture, and they held a competition to find an architect. Is that right?
Yeah, and Eli Brode bankrolled that international competition, and after the process, they selected Rem Koolhaas and his firm OMA in 2015.
So what's going to be built there?
What the renderings show is a three-story structure that's in a trapezoidal shape. There are large windows that look out on Wilshire Boulevard and on the dome roof of the temple. The skin is marked in sort of a honeycomb of hexagonal shapes, and those are inlaid with rectangular windows at odd angles. But I think the thing that one really notices is how it seems to be leaning away from the synagogue. I talked to Rem Koolhaas and asked him why it leans in that way.
We had to show some kind of deference, and so that is the initial gesture, but you see that the shape is irregular to all sides, and so what I think the effect will be that among a number of really stable, symmetrical, abstract buildings, building this one will be alive if you move around it. So it will never be exactly the same in any perspective.
Francis, I think there's another explanation as well, which is that if you have the event center wall closest to the synagogue at, you know, a 90-degree angle, then the area between the buildings, which is used now for outdoor functions, would really feel claustrophobic, like as though you were in an alley.
But still, this addition really does look very different from the existing building, and it almost feels as if OMA's design is kind of ambivalent about the building that it's next to, sort of almost kind of rejecting it in a way.
Yeah, Rem has said that he had no interest in sort of replicating the existing synagogue. There are some connections. The senior rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple, Steve Leader, will talk about how the skin of the event center in a way mimics the interior skin of the synagogue. But, you know, Rem and OMA's New York office head, Shohei Shigematsu, did say that the two buildings will be in dialogue with each other, and asked Rem what that dialogue would sound like.
Well, I think basically all our buildings are in dialogue, but as you can see, the synagogue is a kind of very symmetrical building, very monumental building, very serene building, and the dialogue is between that and an asymmetrical, lively, and not particularly serene building, but a building that wants to emanate vitality. Yeah? So that is a dialogue.
But you specifically set out not to replicate anything about the original synagogue in the event center.
I think that these days you couldn't even begin to replicate, because the different craftsmanship, the different materials, different costs, that doesn't work, even if you wanted to. But of course, I didn't really want to either.
Now, the synagogue was built by Jewish Hollywood moguls during kind of the golden age of Hollywood, and there's a level of showmanship to it. Do you find that there's a level of showmanship to the event center, too?
I wouldn't call it showmanship, but of course, anything that wants to survive today needs to be noted. Yeah.
Now, at this point, we should note that Kool House has designed some of the world's most famous buildings. You know, for example, the CCTV headquarters in Beijing. In the USA, we can think of the Seattle Central Library. There's art museums, consoles in cities around the world. In LA, he's over the years had a number of near misses, one of the most memorable ones being the 2001 redesign for LACMA, where he proposed the same strategy of tearing down the four early buildings, replacing them with a monolithic building that is now being also adopted by Peter Zumthor in his design for the expansion. He did build a Prada store on Rodeo Drive, but this is his first real project in LA. And Avishai, I find the fact that he's doing this project very intriguing because Kool House, perhaps more than anyone, comes across as such a sort of cerebral, secular, European, intellectual. And the idea of him doing a religious building is so fascinating. Did you talk to him about that?
Yes, and Kool House said that he's also very fascinated with the idea of doing a religious or spiritual project. There was a ceremony to mark the start of construction where, you know, there's a children's choir that was singing and some of the major leaders on the project as well as city officials spoke. And Kool House himself gave a few words. And one of the things he mentioned was the fact that this is the first religious and spiritual project that he's done.
We always wanted to try that. Because architecture is such an incredible, heavy engagement with the so-called real world, that to do something which is not directly related to the real world, but to another dimension, is a really very deep pleasure.
Well, after I heard him say that at the ceremony, I asked him to kind of elaborate on that point.
Well, there's so much everydayness in architecture and so much pragmatism and so much rationalism and so much business that it's extremely important and exciting to try to enter a different register.
I mean, you yourself are not religious. You're kind of known as a secularist, right?
I was educated as an atheist. But from the moment I was kind of surrounded by other religions in Indonesia, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, I really felt that atheism was a very inadequate kind of position. So I've always been open to religion, but never quite made it. Yeah.
And how does Judaism compare to the other religions that you'd find yourself open to?
I'm actually not really so much comparing, but really interested in each of them and seeing the similarities and seeing the differences. And of course, I'm from Holland, born in the Second World War, so that always meant a kind of particular connection.
And Avishai, I'm assuming that what he's referencing here was the German invasion and occupation of Holland during the Second World War and the deportation of a large percentage of the country's Jews, most famously, of course, Anne Frank and her family.
That's right. Yeah, that was in 1940. 70% of Holland's Jews were sent to Nazi death camps.
So, Avishai, you got to talk with a rabbi, you met other members of the design team, and I think in the interests of full disclosure, we should say that you are yourself a lapsed congregant at Wilshire Boulevard Temple. What's the vibe in terms of people's reception to this project?
I think there was a lot of excitement about the project. I think especially after the restoration of the synagogue a few years ago, it really feels like the temple is sort of going through a rebirth, just as Wilshire Boulevard is also going through a lot of big changes. And I asked Rem what it means to him to have his first big project in LA be on Wilshire Boulevard.
This has been my favorite road or my favorite street or my favorite boulevard, whatever you call it. And that is really deeply exciting.
So you attended the groundbreaking. When do we expect this building to be completed?
The estimate is late 2020. That said, the cost for the building has jumped from what was $60 million. Now it's something like $85 million. And they're still fundraising. The lead donor on the project is Audrey Ermes. She's a philanthropist and art collector and a longtime member of the temple. She sold a Cy Twombly chalkboard painting for $30 million. And that's why they've named it the Audrey Ermes Pavilion. Another way that they're raising money is through partnerships. For example, they announced that the Annenberg Foundation is going to be housing housing a program center there devoted to meaningful and purposeful aging. So that's also helping to raise money to get the center built.
And I think we should wrap by saying that one of the reasons why Rem Koolhaas was selected was because he's a name that can help bring in the donations. Is that correct?
Yeah. Rabbi Leder said that Rem even came to some of the meetings with major donors just to make sure that they contributed to the project. And I think having somebody like Rem, somebody of that stature, definitely helped open up people's pocketbooks.
And this is not the only project that's going to be going up in Los Angeles by Rem Koolhaas and his firm, OMA. After a long gestation, there's a project in Santa Monica that is going to be going ahead.
Yeah, this is a mixed-use development called Plaza at Santa Monica. It's on Arizona between 4th and 5th. And this is something that residents have pushed back on for something like 8 years because it's high density. And as we know, there's a lot of pushback against density in Santa Monica and in Los Angeles. But Rem seemed pretty relieved that the project is finally moving forward.
I can really understand why Los Angeles is careful about increasing density. But I have to say, I was kind of really surprised by how political the process was and how unpragmatic.
Well, Avishai, very interesting architectural developments for LA. So exciting that you went to that groundbreaking. Thank you.
Thank you, Francis.
Avishai Artsy is DNA's producer. I'm Francis Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, we're going to visit the one-time famed Hollywood dive bar that's going to be making a comeback. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. The 1933 Group is a design and development company that for the past couple decades has been restoring and recreating bars and LA hangouts in painstaking period detail. Think the Idle Hour, Thirsty Crow, Bigfoot Lodge, and the Highland Park Bowl. Well, now they're hard at work on one of LA's most iconic bars, the Formosa Cafe in Hollywood. After almost closing for good, it'll reopen next spring. We went to check out the work in progress, find out how the team plans to restore its character while keeping it current. But before meeting the design team, let's get a quick primer on what has made Formosa so special. From preservationist Chris Nichols. He's associate editor at Los Angeles Magazine.
It's a retired LA streetcar from the glorious years before the streetcar system disappeared, with a restaurant built around it. Of course, it was made legendary in the film LA Confidential, where it sort of plays itself. It's a 1940s celebrity-filled Chinese joint that has sort of a noir edge to it.
For many years, the Formosa Cafe was owned by Lem Kwan. It sits across the street from a studio lot, and it's long been popular with movie stars and then rockers. But things got tough in the early 90s.
My gosh, back in the 90s, that was a big battle. I mean, I was there when they were marching to save the Formosa Cafe the first time,
mm-hmm.
when the West Hollywood Gateway Mall with the Target was built in its parking lot, and sort of right there up against it.
The Formosa Cafe clung on as fancy new bars and cafes sprung up all over LA. And then it got a makeover a couple years back. But that was so ill-received, the place shut down almost immediately afterwards, seemingly for good. Enter the 1933 Group. It is helmed by Dmitry Komarov, Dmitry Lieberman, and Bobby Green.
We're here because we fought to be here. I have followed the Formosa saga for many years, ever since the late 80s. I remember my friends contacting me sometime late 80s, early 90s, and they were going to go picket the place because the studio wanted to tear it down and make it a parking lot. And it's moments like that that you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's something more special about this place other than cool neon and celebrity photographs. And so Dmitry, my partners, once we found out that the property owners were looking for the right caretakers for the place, we threw our name in the hat.
So they submitted detailed plans of how they would preserve and recreate everything that made the Formosa so beloved. And they got the job. They were the right team, says Chris Nichols.
Very excited that that's going to happen. They are the absolute best people. I'm hoping that they will use their tremendous talent and ability to make it appear as we remember it. you know, maybe our memories are rosier than it really was, and they'll make it rosier, you know, which is great. I hope that every historic piece of fabric that's remaining will be intact and will be brought back. So if they can bring back all the historic fabric and overlay that with their incredible, you know, thematic design ability, it's going to be fantastic.
We met Bobby Green and Dmitry Komarov on site. It's a shuttered building on Santa Monica Boulevard between Formosa Avenue and La Brea. Its large neon sign is still intact. Inside, the place is being torn apart and reassembled. Stools and benches are in piles. Dusty red wallpaper clings to the walls. Builders are hard at work.
We are listening to a sander refinishing a lot of the wood in what is the original train car diner portion of the Formosa Cafe. You know, the car is originally from 1902. It's actually the last surviving 800 series Pacific Electric Railroad cars, which is pretty remarkable when you think of the history of the red car in Los Angeles. We have the last one of the original series. It's pretty amazing.
Peeking up through all the piles of stuff, we can see some dusty circular booths. So we sit down and ask how the designers plan to bring the cafe back. Here's Bobby Green again.
You know, first I always start with my memories of the place. The 90s. It's still, even in the 90s, had a very kind of late 40s, early 50s look to it. And that's pretty much the same way it's going to look when you come in today. The bar itself, the train car, those were really the only two sections of the bar that were historic. There was an addition in 2000. They added a rooftop deck, they added a back room, they changed bathrooms and kitchens. So that is where we can be open-minded. We can be a bit creative with that. But you also have to pay close attention to the historic feel of the place. You can't stray too far from that in redoing the back room. It needs to feel a bit like it was always there. And hopefully closer to what our grandparents remember it looking like.
Do your grandparents remember it?
Well, mine are in Oklahoma, so no, they don't. But I have a lot of friends whose grandparents do.
And what do they tell you? What do they say you've got to keep?
Everyone always remembers the celebrity photographs, and they remember the Elvis decanters, and they remember the Lucky Buddha, and the Chinese lanterns. And those elements is what they remember.
And those elements will all be there?
Of course, yes.
Will there be new celebrity photographs, or will you go back to the old? Because I remember all the old ones.
Oh, no, no, no. We're working with Vince Kwan. Now, he's Lim Kwan's grandson. He saved every artifact that was ever in the place. So we're getting everything back and putting it all back where it, I'm going to great lengths to find photographs of the interior prior to things coming out. And we're going to put every picture back exactly where it was, and it'll be the original picture. The reason we even got into the restoration heritage work in Los Angeles is for the last 20 years, we've been building out establishments that were more recreations of things that may have existed in LA or you know, could have existed, you know, log cabin bars and 20s cocktail lounges. But because of that, we were known for our love of vintage and our love of old LA. And it's not only rewarding personally, but it's rewarding to the neighborhood, and it's rewarding to the city, and it's rewarding to the people who come to us and thank us. I've had people send me pictures of themselves as little kids actually sitting right here where we are now at the Formosa. You know, we came here in the 70s or the 60s. So it just adds this really deep layer of love and appreciation to a place, and we are thrilled to bring it back.
Let's step back a quick moment and just ask you about the founding of your company. It's called 1933. Why 1933?
There's a special significance of 1933, which coincides with what we do. It was the year Prohibition was repealed. I mean, it must have been a pretty exciting time. You know, imagine you know, since 1920 to 1933 not being able to buy legal whiskey. But there are ways around that
sure.
At that time, for sure.
We uncovered a lot of funny history with that as well. A really funny story about Highland Park Bowl. When the space had two front windows. The one on the right was a pharmacy. The one on the left was a music store. And there was doctor's offices upstairs. And during Prohibition, people would walk in and get their prescription from the doctor's offices upstairs, go downstairs and get their liquor from the pharmacy. And in the back, there was a huge speakeasy where the bowling alley was.
Yeah. And it turns out this pharmacy company built the bowling alley specifically for this reason during Prohibition. So in 1927, I mean, you're deep in Prohibition by that time. You're 7 years in. And I think this pharmacy owned other pharmacies, and they were selling prescription whiskeys, and they were being quite lucrative, I'm sure. Probably similar to the way that prescription marijuana, yeah, you know, is today. And so they created this idea. Let's make one space, bowling, live music, doctor's offices, one-stop shop. It must have been pretty wild for a few years.
The Highland Park Bowl definitely put you guys on the map. How much of that was almost production design, and how much was revival of what was actually there?
You know, surprisingly, the majority of what you see in the place is the original bones. We've probably done 15, 16 places now to date. And every place has so many layers to it, you know, because there were 50s remodels, 60s remodels, 70s, 80s remodels, and all of those add layers and layers and layers. And the bowling alley was no exception. So it took probably 4 months alone of just demo, you know, stripping the layers out, stripping the old ceiling, stripping the walls, getting it back to the building that was built in 1927 and exposing all those elements. Now, as far as production design, there's a bit, but I wanted to use the elements of the original place and kind of showcase them. The banners that hang on the wall, the old hand-painted signs of the bowling leagues, all that stuff was found upstairs. They never threw anything away. So it was just massive amounts of storage. So it was just fun just digging through 80% trash and finding 20% treasures and then being able to kind of show those again to people.
Do you get to a point as you recreate an interior like that where you say, okay, at this point we stop, because if we go too much further, it'll go into the sort of terrain of precious and then it'll start to feel like a museum. How do you make something keep its life while being a sort of recreation or remaking of the past?
Yeah, I've always been the less is more type of person. I mean, so there's a beauty in simplicity. I would say from my partner's standpoint, there's also a beauty in not going over budget. You know, I pretty much edit daily, because as a designer, you're looking at every detail. And if you look at every detail as its own project, it can get way too much. You know, so you need to keep each element somewhat simple.
We've learned over the years now what we need to spend money on and what is not going to be that important or not going to make a difference. Highland Park Bowl, you know, we could have put a wood floor in the whole place, or we could have left the original concrete. And we realized the wood floor was not going to add too much to the space, but in another place we would have spent it. I think we have to play with the space to figure out what works and what doesn't.
And you've got another really interesting project in the pipeline, and that's Tale of the Pup.
Yes. It will once again live as the Tale of the Pup. We have the original neon sign. We plan to sell hot dogs, obviously, because it's a giant hot dog. We'd love to add maybe a little bit more, maybe a beer garden or more outdoor seating, something a little bit. But we want to keep it as pure and true to what it originally was as possible. We bought it from the original surviving family. The kids of the original owners really wanted to see the place brought back to LA. And so several people kept telling them, well, if you ever want to see this thing live again, you need to contact these guys. And luckily they did.
But its future is uncertain, it sounds, from what you're saying, in terms of where it's going to land. So you really are looking for...
We've actually made a call to the city for submissions to let us know of any available spaces.
But our goal is to get the Tale of the Pup back as close to possible as the original location, West Hollywood area, Hollywood.
I have heard your work characterized affectionately as hipster Disneyland.
That's pretty funny.
It was Avishai. Since you like it, now I'll give him the credit. Do you think that's a fair summary?
I'll take that, you know. I've always admired Walt Disney. I mean, you know, he created something very interesting that has lasted the test of time, and people still really enjoy it. He's created a fantasy world that takes people away from the stresses of their daily lives. It's the same thing we do. I mean, I want everyone that comes into any of our bars on any given night to forget the fight they had with their boss, or the stresses they just had at work, or on the freeway in traffic. So it's the same thing. I'll take that as a compliment. The hipster part, maybe not, but you can leave the Disney part in there.
But you do look like a bit of a hipster, Bobby.
Do I? I'm too old to be a hipster. That's the problem.
Hipsters are growing up now.
I suppose you're right. I've just always loved vintage. So if looking like you walked out of the 1930s means you're a hipster, I guess I can live with that.
That's Bobby Green and Dmitry Komarov of the 1933 group. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now, sometimes the 1933 group is successful, perhaps even to a fault. And that's because projects like the Highland Park Bowls sometimes get folded into charges of gentrification. We went back to their big supporter, Chris Nichols, the preservationist and associate editor at LA Magazine.
I don't think that historic buildings should have to suffer for politics. You know, yes, I certainly understand being priced out of a place. It's happened to me. But I don't think that historic buildings should have to suffer for it. And I don't think that somebody that cares about the, you know, integrity and the history and the aesthetics of a place is a bad person. And I don't know that the former Mr. T's Bowl was necessarily thriving. Maybe there's a reason they sold it. You know, there's a reason they left, and the reason that they were no longer operating it as the sort of rock and roll dive bar that it had devolved into. And so when these folks came in and had the resources to put it back, you know, God bless them. That's great. And, you know, anybody can go in and enjoy it for the price of a beer.
To what extent can work by the 1933 group, these kind of very intimate preservation projects, be used by developers to advance a project that might otherwise be perhaps a rather large, very dense project, but there'll be some little discrete building that they can use to kind of help with the marketing?
Do you mean like the way that the Formosa is part of the West Hollywood Gateway project?
I suppose you could say that.
Well, I mean, that all happened before them, of course. But, you know, that was a success, and that project was built around it, and I think there's always room to carve out a corner for an important piece of architecture, an important piece of history, you know, in these mega projects. Of course, you know, I think you need to be respectful and give it a little breathing room, but, you know, I'm all for the little house, the little piece that's maintained in a place where a neighborhood has changed. You know, and I think the Formosa is going to be wildly successful in that location. And I think it's going to be spectacular when you're inside. And yes, when you're outside, there's a big hulking Target right next to you. But that's a different battle.
That was Chris Nichols, preservationist and associate editor at Los Angeles Magazine. I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. Avishai Artsy produced and edited this program with final mix by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajian. Thank you very much for listening. Have a very happy Thanksgiving, and we'll be back next week.